months ago, we saw Knox returning to Scotland in May 1559. What had been happening in Scotland since Knox's departure for the French galleys in 1547? Well, popular Protestantism had been kept alive by various means. One of these was a book entitled The Good and Godly Ballads, which had quite a wide circulation and made quite an impact. The Good and Godly Ballads was divided into two sections. In section one, there was a catechism, which dealt with the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, and the sacraments. There were 16 spiritual songs based on Bible passages, and there were ballads, where the words were intended to replace the lyrics of secular songs. And then in section two, there were 20 psalms and, again, 40 ballads, mostly anti-Roman Catholic pieces, which had the nature of satire. The Good and Godly Ballads were put together largely by the Wedderburn brothers, James and John Wedderburn, although others probably contributed. And really, the ballads were remarkably effective at communicating Protestant doctrine and promoting an attitude of satire towards Roman Catholicism. One of the more well-known ballads has the verse, "The Pope, that pagan full of pride, he hath us blinded long. For where the blind doth guide, no wonder both go wrong. Like prince and king, he led the reign of all iniquity. Hey, tricks, trim go, tricks under the greenwood tree." The Roman Catholic Church in Scotland also undertook some effort at trying to reform itself in this period. There were Scottish church councils in 1549 and 1552. These were led by Archbishop Hamilton of St. Andrews. These councils enacted various reforming measures. Parishes and monasteries were to be regularly visited by bishops. Plans for the better education of the clergy were drawn up, which included finalising St. Mary's College at St. Andrews. But the most remarkable product of these reforming councils was Hamilton's Catechism. In many ways, this catechism was a compromise between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. There is no mention of the papacy at all, which is rather remarkable in a Roman Catholic catechism, and its teaching about the Lord's Supper resembled that of Luther. However, these reforming efforts were looked on as being half-hearted and half-baked by Protestants, and they did nothing to conciliate Protestant opinion. In 1554, the Regency of Scotland was assumed by Mary of Guise, the widow of King James V, the mother of the 12-year-old Mary Stuart, the future Mary Queen of Scots. There's a portrait of Mary of Guise there. As I said earlier on, the daughter of related to the great Guise family in France. Now, at first, Mary was reasonably tolerant of Protestants. She wanted to win them over to her anti-English, pro-French policy. But there was growing resentment among many Scots at the way Scotland seemed to be becoming a mere French province, especially after young Mary Stuart was married to Prince Francis of France, the heir to the French throne. Scottish nobles may have remembered that it was a royal marriage which had resulted in the French crown's annexation of Brittany in 1532. Was Scotland to go the same way? And this fear of French domination played into the whole religious conflict. France was Roman Catholic, so anti-French feeling and anti-Roman Catholic feeling quite easily came together and coalesced. Or to put that positively, to put it the other way round, the cause of Scottish nationalism became increasingly identified with the cause of Protestantism. Now, within that sort of context, the Protestant members of the Scottish nobility were becoming increasingly radical in their determination to secure a Protestant government for Scotland. On the 3rd of December, 1557, the leaders of the Protestant nobility banded together by signing a covenant in which they pledged themselves to establish God's word and his church, or his congregation, as they called it, to defend Protestant preachers against persecution, and to renounce Roman Catholicism as the congregation of Satan. They also proposed a positive program for the reform of worship. They called for Sunday worship to be carried out according to the Anglican prayer book, and for freedom of Protestant preaching. These Protestant nobles called themselves the Lords of the Congregation of Jesus Christ. Now, this practice of covenanting, and by the way, we mustn't confuse this with the Covenanters. They were later in the 17th century. We're not quite in the covenanting era yet. This practice of covenanting was partly an old Scottish custom. One historian says parties were freely formed, often by the drawing up of formal bonds, pledging the signatories to act in concert. So there was that element of Scottish custom in the practice of covenanting, but probably in this instance it owed rather more to the biblical notion of a covenant, the covenant between God and Israel. The covenant that was signed by the Protestant nobles says this: "We, perceiving how Satan in his members, the antichrists of our time, cruelly doth rage, seeking to overthrow and to destroy the gospel of Christ and his congregation, ought, according to our bounden duty, to strive in our master's cause, even unto death, being certain of the victory in him. This our duty being well considered, we do promise before the majesty of God and his congregation, that we by his grace shall with all diligence continually apply our whole power, substance, and our very lives to maintain, set forward, and establish the most blessed word of God and his congregation, and shall labour at our possibility to have faithful ministers purely and truly to minister Christ's gospel and sacraments to his people." The covenant was signed by the Earl of Argyll, the Earl of Glencairn, the Earl of Morton, Lord Lorne, and John Erskine of Dun. In early 1558, under the auspices of the Lords of the Congregation, Scottish Protestants began openly appointing Protestant preachers for themselves, who often led worship according to the English prayer book. In 1558 and 1559, there were outbreaks of image smashing. Smashing things like statues of saints and of the Virgin Mary, stained glass windows, that sort of thing. And each of these outbreaks was more devastating than its predecessor. Clearly the upsurge in popular Protestantism was reaching a crisis point. Persecution fanned the flames. The last Protestant martyr to be burnt at the stake in Scotland was Walter Milne, a school teacher aged 82. Burnt in April 1558. Milne's death was seen as an act of cruelty and proved very counterproductive. John Knox commented that out of the ashes of Walter Milne sprang thousands of his opinion and religion in Scotland. In July 1558, Mary summoned the Protestant preachers to give an account of their activities. This summons provoked a show of force by the Protestant gentry of Western Scotland. They turned out bearing arms to protect their preachers. Mary panicked and cancelled the summons. More image-smashing riots broke out, even in Edinburgh. Protestants there disrupted a religious procession in celebration of Edinburgh's patron saint, St. Giles. They seized his statue and threw it in the Nore Loch. In January 1559, a broadsheet called the Beggar's Summons was nailed on the doors of Scottish friaries, calling upon the friars to leave in favour of the poor and threatening forcible eviction if they hadn't left by Pentecost Sunday. Well, it was at this point that Knox now returned from Geneva to Scotland. As I said, he arrived in May 1559. Now, in fact, he'd left Geneva in January. It took him 4 months to get to Scotland because the new English Queen Elizabeth refused to grant him permission to travel through England. She was still offended by his first blast of the trumpet. Once Knox had finally made it back to Scotland, he stepped naturally into a position of spiritual leadership over the lords of the congregation. He was now 46 years old and on the brink of the great crisis of his career as the reformer of Scotland. He preached with great effect in Dundee and Perth. The two cities openly declared themselves to be Protestant cities, and so did the town of Ayr. Knox's sermon in Perth famously resulted in a riot. There's been debate concerning Knox's own precise role in this. What happened was that in his sermon, Knox preached against the sin of idolatry. And under that heading, he included the Roman Catholic Mass because of the practice of adoring the wafer. After the sermon, a Roman Catholic priest, probably with more courage than common sense, decided to stage an act of defiance by celebrating the Mass. A teenage boy cried out, "This is intolerable, that when God by his word has plainly condemned idolatry, we shall stand and see it practiced." The priest struck the boy. The boy threw a stone, which hit and broke an image. Others joined in the stone throwing, and soon all the images had been broken. The action spread, and soon the whole of Perth had been purged of its Roman Catholic images. Knox condemned this action as the work of the rascal multitude, but he seems in private to have approved of the religious fervour which lay behind the outbreak. A new covenant was drawn up in Perth by the Lords of the Congregation for the defence of Protestantism. Mary of Guise mobilised her forces, an army of 8,000, in order to take decisive action, but this merely provoked a Protestant counter-mobilisation. Mary was forced to agree to a truce, and she entered Perth under a solemn promise that she would not persecute Protestants. At this point, Lord James Stuart, the future Regent Murray, Mary's half-brother, joined the Lords of the Congregation. And there's a portrait there of the Earl of Murray. And we'll be coming across him again and again in the unfolding story, quite an important figure. It was at this point that he joined the Lords of the Congregation, breaking ranks with Mary. The turning point for Stuart, James Stuart, seems to have been the behaviour of Mary's troops in Perth. They treated its Protestant citizens with rough contempt. The Lords of the Congregation now resumed the offensive and occupied St. Andrews. Their triumph there was very solid. There seems to have been a powerful Protestant underground in St. Andrews. And then they also occupied Edinburgh, where they weren't so well received. Mary's French army was powerful enough to prevent the Lords from carrying out their plan, and they retreated from Edinburgh back to Stirling. In Stirling, they received a great morale boost, where they were joined by Arran, the ex-governor, the one who'd presided over that brief Indian summer of Protestantism back in 1543. And from this point, Arran became the nominal head of the Lords of the Congregation. They now opened negotiations with England, England which had been Protestant since Elizabeth's accession in November 1558, and Elizabeth gave the Lords of the Congregation a grant of £3,000. That's nothing in today's currency, of course, but that was a small fortune back then. In October, the Lords of the Congregation reoccupied Edinburgh with an army of 8,000. They declared Mary of Guise to be deposed from the regency, and they called for a great council of the realm to act as a provisional Protestant government. Mary, however, counter-attacked. She drove the Lords out of Edinburgh and looked as though she might inflict military defeat on them. Only John Knox's remarkable preaching kept alive the courage and constancy of the Protestant army. And then, January 1560, the entire situation was suddenly transformed. An English Protestant fleet appeared in the Firth of Forth. and it cut the French supply lines. Mary's forces beat a hasty retreat back to Leith. This event tipped the scales of fortune back to the lords of the Congregation. They signed the Treaty of Berwick with Elizabeth in February, and in April an English Protestant army arrived on Scottish soil. So the balance of power now lay very decisively with the Protestant forces. The French army was put under siege in Leith, both by land and by sea, the sea part of the siege being carried out by the English fleet. In June, Mary of Guise died of natural causes, and the French army immediately surrendered. On July the 6th, the Treaty of Edinburgh between England and France brought about the withdrawal of both English and French forces from Scotland. The Scots were not actually privy to the treaty at all, but annexed to it was a series of concessions to the Scots. No more French troops to be sent to Scotland. No foreigner to be appointed to any crown office. The government to be entrusted to a council of 12. The Scottish Parliament to be called to meet on July the 10th. So the immediate aftermath of the Treaty of Edinburgh was the Reformation Parliament, as it's called, of July and August 1560. The summoning of Parliament was authorised by the French commissioners of King Francis II of France and his wife, Mary Queen of Scots. In a very real sense, the official triumph of Protestantism in Scotland was due to English intervention. The fortunes of Roman Catholicism depended on the Franco-Scottish axis. The fortunes of Protestantism depended on the Anglo-Scottish axis. Now, the Scottish Parliament at this time, we mustn't think of it in terms of a modern democratic body. It was an upper-class body made up of the aristocracy, the gentry, and high-ranking clergy, and they mostly sat by right, not by election. When the Parliament met in July, it was well attended. There were 14 earls, 6 bishops, 19 lesser lords, 21 abbots, 100 named barons, and many other barons and landed men who claimed the right to be present. There were also deputies or commissions from 22 towns and cities. The opening session of Parliament was on July the 10th. A petition was received for the condemnation of transubstantiation, justification by works, indulgences, purgatory, praying to saints and papal authority, and for the restoration of the discipline of the early church and the redistribution of the church's property in favour of the poor, the ministry and schools. On the 17th of August, Parliament approved a new reformed confession of faith. This was the Scots Confession. The Scots Confession was drawn up by John Knox and 5 other leading reformed men: John Willock, John Winram, John Spottiswood, John Rowe and John Douglas. So the 6 Johns. It's very clearly a reformed confession of faith. The new Protestant Church of Scotland was to be a reformed, not a Lutheran body. Most obviously, the confession embraces the reformed view of the Lord's Supper. One of its most striking features is the strength and richness of its teaching about the Lord's Supper. It emphasizes the real spiritual eating and drinking of Christ's body and blood by the faithful. The confession is divided into 25 articles. The first 12 are largely non-controversial. They're just an exposition of traditional Christianity rooted in the Apostles' Creed. Although there are some elements of Reformed theology here, such as Article 8, which deals with the doctrine of election. The other 13 articles are distinctively Protestant. They affirm the supreme authority of Scripture and other such basic Reformation beliefs. 2 unusual elements in the Scots Confession have often been noted. One is the way that it highlights history, the outworking of God's purposes in space and time from Adam onwards. If you look at the way the confession is put together, it reads just as much as a piece of history as it does a piece of systematic theology. And the other element that's often remarked on is the great stress the confession places on the doctrine of the church. A dominant theme running right through the confession is the conflict between the true and false church, and the importance of recognizing and belonging to the true church. On the 24th of August, Parliament abolished the Mass with penalties for its celebration, recognized the Reformed preachers as being alone competent to administer the sacraments, and abolished all papal jurisdiction over Scotland. There was hardly any resistance in Parliament to these Protestant measures. Of the nobility, only 3 of the 14 earls and 2 of the 19 lesser lords voted against the Scots Confession out of loyalty to the old church. Of the 6 bishops who bothered to turn up, only 3 put up any opposition. The tide of public opinion among the educated and ruling classes had clearly turned in a decisively Protestant direction. Now, with all this activity of Parliament and legislation in establishing Protestantism as the official faith of Scotland, we may perhaps wonder why our 16th century ancestors had such a public view of religion. Isn't religion a private matter for individual conscience? Well, it is in modern thinking, but if we project those attitudes back into 16th century Scotland, or indeed 16th century Europe, we simply won't understand the motivations of the people of that time, either Roman Catholics or Protestants. They did not regard Christianity as private faith. They regarded it as the glue that holds society together, the moral basis for the state and its legislation. And that's why the Scottish reformers enacted these legal constitutional instruments to establish Protestantism as the public faith. The idea that all faiths should be equally tolerated by a religiously neutral state would have been utterly incomprehensible to Roman Catholics and Protestants alike in the 16th century. But having said that, it's still worth noting that as far as we know, no Roman Catholic was ever put to death for his faith by the new Protestant state in Scotland. Now, young Queen Mary refused to ratify the legislation, but it was finally ratified by the first Parliament of James VI's reign in 1567. 2 other great documents alongside the Scots Confession also emerged out of the Reformation settlement. First of all, the Book of Common Order, and then secondly, the Book of Discipline. Let's just have a quick look at them. The Book of Common Order, this was to do with the whole question of worship. Ever since 1556, Scottish Protestants have been organising their own congregations. Prior to the Reformation Parliament, they'd been using the English Book of Common Prayer. It had been brought to Scotland by Scottish preachers who, like Knox, had served in the English Reformed Church in the days of Edward VI. The Lords of the Congregation, in their first covenant, said, "It is thought expedient, devised and ordained, that in all parishes of this realm the common prayers be read weekly on Sundays and other feast days publicly in the parish churches." Scottish Protestant worship was thus originally taken over from Protestant England, Book of Common Prayer. Now, since the official triumph of Scottish Protestantism was due to English intervention, it might be thought that uniformity of worship would prevail in the two kingdoms, with the Scottish Reformed Church worshipping according to the manner of the English Book of Common Prayer. This, in fact, did not happen. Why not? Well, one possible reason is that Elizabeth's Book of Common Prayer wasn't quite so radically Protestant as King Edward VI's prayer book. Furthermore, while in exile on the continent, Knox had developed a preference for Calvin's Geneva liturgy. It was simpler, it was more streamlined than the Book of Common Prayer. Knox's English version of Calvin's liturgy is referred to, in the parlance of the time, as the Book of Common Order. More commonly, it's known as Knox's liturgy. Its printed title is "The Form of Prayers and Ministration of the Sacraments Used in the English Congregation at Geneva." Knox brought it back with him to Scotland. It was printed in Edinburgh in 1562 and authorized by the General Assembly that year. In 1564, an enlarged edition appeared with the addition of metrical psalms. The Book of Common Order remained the worship book of Scottish Protestantism for almost 100 years, until it was replaced by the Westminster Directory of Public Worship in 1645. The Book of Common Order contains the Genevan Church's Confession of Faith and various forms for public worship, the election of superintendents, ministers, elders and deacons, marriage, burial, the visitation of the sick, church discipline, and a general fast. The Book of Common Order isn't so prescriptive as the Anglican Prayer Book. The Anglican Prayer Book is a fixed form. It tells exactly what to do, exactly what to say. The Book of Common Order isn't like that. It's more of a guide rather than a fixed form. Nevertheless, it was intended to be used by ministers, and its use was prescribed for readers. The form of public worship included the Lord's Prayer and the Apostles' Creed. The Lord's Supper was intended to be observed once a month, although in practice it was less frequent. Here's an outline of the service of worship according to the Book of Common Order. It began with a confession of sin, then followed a prayer for pardon. After that came the singing of a metrical psalm. Then there was a prayer for illumination, then a reading from Scripture, then the sermon. Then an offering was collected for the poor. Then followed the so-called long prayer, culminating in the Lord's Prayer. Then came the Apostles' Creed, then the singing of another metrical psalm, and then the benediction. And as I said, I've got a copy of the liturgy here, the Book of Common Order, if anyone wants to have a look at it. So that was the first of the two great documents, the Book of Common Order. The other one, the Book of Discipline, as it was called. Now, the Book of Discipline was a sort of blueprint for a Protestant society. In terms of what it says about the church, it outlines a form of church government, which includes the election of ministers by congregations, elders who were to assist ministers in the exercise of church discipline, deacons who were to take charge of the finances of the church. Where the disorganized state of the times meant that there was no minister in a congregation, the Book of Discipline appointed readers who were to conduct services from the Book of Common Order, exhorters who could deliver sermons but not administer the sacraments, and superintendents who were to exercise spiritual oversight over large areas of the country and be accountable to the General Assembly. The General Assembly at this time was not quite the classic Presbyterian body it later became in this early stage of the Scottish Reformation. The General Assembly included barons and burgesses, as well as ministers and elders. It was more like an ecclesiastical version of Parliament. The Book of Discipline also set out a programme of poor relief on a scale unknown in Western Europe until the coming of the welfare state. A massive educational programme was also blueprinted. Every parish was to have a school as well as a church. And all of this was to be financed by the wealth of the old church. Now that was the blueprint. It largely failed to materialise. In fact, there was a certain democratic tone running through the Book of Discipline which made the Scottish nobility rather uneasy. Most of them preferred to seize the assets of the old church for themselves rather than for this utopian programme that Knox had outlined. Certainly Knox was deeply disillusioned. His verdict on the covetousness of the Scottish nobles was "the belly has no ears." Most of the ministers in the new Reformed Church would have to subsist on a mere pittance for pay. And in fact, by the end of 1560, the General Assembly was already advising ministers to rely on charitable gifts rather than regular income. The educational vision of the Book of Discipline was put into practice in a very modified form. The failure of the Book of Discipline ensured that for the next 70 years there would be serious tensions between church and state, between preachers and nobles. Now, the triumph of Protestantism in Scotland through the Reformation Parliament had a profound impact both on Scottish identity and on Anglo-Scottish relationships. Traditionally, England had been the old enemy of Scotland, and Scots had in some senses defined themselves as those who existed in a context of hostilities with the English. The Reformation changed all of this. With the victory of Protestantism over Roman Catholicism in both England and Scotland, and with English help in Scotland, forged a new bond between the two nations. Especially when the forces of the Catholic Counter-Reformation began their concerted effort across Europe to win back the territory that had been lost to Protestantism, Scotland and England found themselves drawn even closer together. So both in Scotland and England, a deep-rooted anti-Catholic feeling became ingrained into the national psyche. So bearing all this in mind, it's not surprising that Protestant Scotland became a pro-English country. Now, it could be argued that the Scottish Protestant nationalism, which had expelled the French from Scotland, was in danger of itself going to the opposite extreme, that is, of delivering Scotland from France, only to make her a mere client state of England. From 1560 to the end of the 16th century, the new Protestant Scotland would rely significantly on English political support and English financial support. But the danger of playing second fiddle to England was offset in that period by the fact that Elizabeth of England was unmarried, childless, and without an heir. The possibility, therefore, loomed of the Scottish king succeeding to the English throne. Now, although it wasn't until the last moment of her life that Elizabeth finally made King James VI of Scotland her heir, that potential had been kept dangling before him for years. And that meant that Scotland could hope for an England ruled by a Scottish king, a reassuring prospect. How far did Protestantism triumph at the grassroots level in 1560? Let's take Edinburgh as a case study. When Edinburgh had been offered a referendum on its religious loyalties in 1559, the Protestants of Edinburgh rejected the idea. God's truth must not be made subject to human votes, they said. That may suggest they weren't confident of winning the referendum. After the political triumph of the Reformation in 1560, Edinburgh remained collectively unsure of its religious position. So at the Easter Communion service in 1561, only 1,200 adults out of Edinburgh's 12,500 attended the new Protestant service. Nevertheless, there was no vocal opposition. The majority of Edinburgh's inhabitants seemed to have had no real commitment to either side in the religious conflict. And that may well have been a fairly typical attitude in many of the towns and cities of Scotland, with the notable exceptions of Perth and Dundee, which were hotbeds of Protestant fervour. As a result, most of the new Protestant parish ministers were in the position of missionaries in an environment that was usually suspicious rather than outright unfriendly or hostile, to quote a modern historian. By the opening decades of the 17th century, the Reformed Church had largely succeeded in evangelising and Protestantising the Scottish lowlands, where the Reformation took deep popular root. But not so in the Highlands. The only part of the Highlands where Protestantism found strong support was in Argyllshire, and that was owing to the personal commitment to the Reformation by the Earls of Argyll, the Campbells. The Campbells were one of the two most politically important family groups in the Highlands, the other being the Gordons. When the Lords of the Congregation signed their first covenant in 1557, the first signature on the list is the Earl of Argyll. And in the 17th century, the most uncompromising of the Covenanters among the nobility was to be the Marquis of Argyll. But Argyll and the Campbell clan were unusual among the Highland nobility, and outside of Campbell territory, Protestantism made very little popular impact in the Highlands in the 16th century. That doesn't mean that the Scottish Reformed Church made no effort to establish itself in the Highlands. It did. Protestant parish ministers were planted in the region. But there was a huge practical problem. There was a language barrier. Gaelic was the lingua franca of the Highland people. Very few Protestant ministers spoke anything other than English. However, even here, there were some positive elements. The first ever book to be printed in the Gaelic language was the Book of Common Order, Knox's Liturgy. It was translated by John Carswell and published in 1567. And that's a landmark in the history of Gaelic culture. A Protestant liturgy marked the arrival of Gaelic as a printed, published language. On December the 11th, 1560, King Francis II of France died very young. His widow Mary, Queen of Scots, Scotland's lawful queen, was 18 years old and a Roman Catholic. And there's a portrait of Mary there. Mary, Queen of Scots, the last picture in the portfolio. It seemed likely that Mary would return to Scotland. She immediately became the focus for Roman Catholic discontent. Scottish Roman Catholics expected Mary to come home and overthrow the Reformation settlement. So in early 1561, Leslie, a prominent Roman Catholic clergyman from Aberdeen, visited Mary in France and promised that if Mary came to Aberdeen, the powerful Roman Catholic Earl of Huntly would raise an army of 20,000 and enable her to crush the Protestants and enter Edinburgh in triumph. On the other hand, many Scottish Protestants entertained hopes of Mary. Her half-brother James Stuart, soon to be the Earl of Murray, representing the Protestant party, also visited her. Now Stuart, or Murray as he became, was a rather unusual politician. He was a man of such awesome purity and integrity in his private life that some found him utterly repellent. They saw in him a sort of cold austerity that somehow always managed to coincide with ambitious worldly aims. But there could be no doubting his loyalty to the Reformation, and he certainly stood high in John Knox's esteem. Stuart then visited Mary, and he probably promised her that the Protestants of Scotland would support her claim to the English throne if she would live with the Protestant settlement that had been made in Scotland. Now that thing about Mary, Queen of Scots, having a claim to the English throne should perhaps be explained. Mary was the granddaughter of Margaret Tudor, and Margaret Tudor was the daughter of King Henry VII of England. So Mary, Queen of Scots, did in fact have a claim to the English throne, and in fact, in the eyes of English Roman Catholics, she was the rightful Queen of England, because the English Roman Catholics, or a good number of them, would not acknowledge any Protestant sovereign, so they wouldn't acknowledge Elizabeth as being their rightful queen. The Protestant party there in Scotland would uphold Mary's claim to the English throne by trying to persuade Elizabeth to recognise Mary as her successor. And on that basis, the Scottish Protestants hoped that if Mary came to Scotland, she would drop the Franco-Scottish alliance for an Anglo-Scottish alliance, and that in turn that might persuade Mary to embrace Protestantism. Well, Mary arrived in Scotland, in Leith, in August 1561, and set up her court in Holyrood Palace. She was young, beautiful, charming, spirited, highly intelligent, and well-educated in all the learning of the French Renaissance. These qualities won her widespread popularity, and few men, even devout Protestant men, could resist her attractions, with one notable exception, John Knox. Despite Mary's Roman Catholicism, she chose to commit herself to the pro-English Protestant party, whose figurehead was James Stuart, but whose real leader was William Maitland of Lethington. However opposed they were to Mary's faith, Stuart and Maitland were staunch advocates of her claim to the English throne. Mary elevated Stuart to the rank of the Earl of Murray, and that's the title by which he's commonly known to history. She then undertook a successful publicity tour of Scotland, masterminded by Murray. And she accompanied Murray on his military campaign against the Roman Catholic Earl of Huntly. Huntly's forces were annihilated, and that dealt a body blow to the Roman Catholic cause in Scotland. Thus far, the working alliance between Mary and the Protestant party seemed to be effective. But there were problems. After Mary established herself in Edinburgh, she arranged for the Roman Catholic Mass to be celebrated in Holyrood. This infuriated the Protestant mob, and they marched on the palace. Only the personal intervention of Murray stopped them breaking in. A gulf quickly opened up between the Protestant nobility and the common people. The Queen's Privy Council, composed entirely of Protestant nobles, were determined to secure for Mary the freedom to practice her own faith. The common people, led by John Knox, regarded the Mass as idolatry, and they were convinced that a Christian state should not tolerate idolatry. Knox, who was now Minister of St. Giles in Edinburgh, affirmed in a sermon that one Mass was more dreadful than an invasion of Scotland by 10,000 Roman Catholic troops. Knox not only objected to the idolatry, he also interpreted the Privy Council's lenient attitude as a weakening of Protestant resolve, the first step on the slippery slope that would lead to the revival of Roman Catholicism. Knox's attitude led to a rupture with Murray, who up until then had been Knox's most devoted ally among the nobles. They didn't speak to each other for 18 months. Relations between Knox and Mary herself were obviously very strained. Even before Mary returned to Scotland, she declared that Knox was the most dangerous man in the country, and it was not big enough to hold both of them. Knox, for his part, never ceased to regard Mary as the niece of the wicked Guise nobility in France, who were chiefly responsible for persecuting French Protestants. Mary had a very exalted conception of her royal authority and the obedience owed her by her subjects. Even in matters of religion, Mary's view was that the faith of the ruler should determine the faith of the subjects. Knox held equally exalted views of the duty of a Christian preacher to proclaim the word of God without fear or favour even to monarchs. Now, Mary didn't worship at St. Giles, but Knox's utterances from the pulpit were reported to her. He condemned the frivolity of her court, he denounced the Mass, and worst of all, he called on the Protestant nobles to resist Mary's proposed marriage to the Roman Catholic prince Don Carlos, the son of Philip II of Spain. As a result of these pulpit utterances, Knox was summoned into Mary's presence four times to account for himself. Knox generally got the better of Mary in these famous exchanges, on one occasion reducing her to hysterical tears. Soon after the fourth interview, Mary lost all patience with Knox and had him put on trial for treason. The occasion for this was because Knox had circulated a letter to Protestant friends urging them to meet in Edinburgh on the day fixed for the trial of two members of Knox's congregation. They'd been arrested for having entered Mary's chapel at Holyrood. Knox's trial for treason took place before the whole Privy Council, where to Mary's disgust he was unanimously acquitted. In March 1564, Knox married for a second time. His first wife, Marjorie, had died in 1560, during the Reformation Parliament. His second wife was Margaret Stuart, the daughter of Lord Ochiltree, an old friend of Knox's. The marriage caused some degree of scandal, because Knox was now 50 and Margaret was only 17. The reformer's enemies accused him of employing witchcraft to befuddle the wits of young Margaret. However, the marriage can be partly explained by Knox's friendship with Lord Ochiltree, one of the few men who had stood by him in every trial. Knox needed a wife to look after his two young sons by Margery. And certainly his marriage to Margaret was in itself very happy and successful. And she bore him three daughters. But what of public affairs? How much longer could Scotland contain both John Knox and Mary, Queen of Scots? Well, not much longer, although Mary's downfall was brought about by her own actions rather than by Knox. It began in 1565 when Mary fell in love with the young Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, a Roman Catholic, marrying him according to Roman Catholic ceremonial in July. This alienated even the moderate Protestant nobles. They saw this marriage as the first step towards the destruction both of their power and of Protestantism itself in Scotland. Encouraged by Elizabeth of England, Murray took up arms in defence of the Reformation, but Mary successfully crushed his rebellion, forcing Murray and other Protestant nobles to flee to England. But tragedy followed this triumph. Mary's marriage to Darnley was not a success, and she fell increasingly under the sway of her Italian counsellor, David Rizzio. Darnley became insane with jealousy, and in March 1566, he took part in a plot to eliminate Rizzio. A band of men, including Darnley himself, broke into Holyrood Palace and into the Queen's supper room, where she and Rizzio were dining together. Rizzio was dragged away and stabbed to death. This event destroyed Mary's loyalty to Darnley. She now cast her affections on the Protestant Earl of Bothwell, James Hepburn, unfortunately a married man. A year after Rizzio's murder, on February the 8th, 1567, Darnley himself was strangled by murderers in Kirkafield, a church just outside the walls of Edinburgh, and the church was then blown up. Bothwell was universally believed to be the man behind Darnley's murder. A few months later, Bothwell kidnapped Mary and took her to Dunbar Castle. Bothwell's divorce from his wife was then hurried through the courts with unseemly haste, and he and Mary were married in Holyrood on May 15th. This act left Mary totally isolated. The Protestant nobility were now hostile to her, and by marrying a Protestant, she'd now lost the support of Roman Catholics as well. In the absence of Murray, who was still in England, another leading Protestant noble, James Douglas, the Earl of Morton, raised a Protestant army and trapped Mary's smaller force at Carberry Hill. There they demanded that she hand over Bothwell for trial on the charge of Darnley's murder. Mary contrived the escape of Bothwell to Norway, and then she surrendered to Morton. She was taken to Edinburgh, where the city mob turned out in force, crying, "Burn the whore!" Clearly, no love lost between Mary and her capital city. She was then imprisoned in Lochleven Castle and forced to abdicate on July the 24th in favour of her newborn son, James the 6th. Murray, back from England, became the Regent of Scotland. Mary was kept prisoner at Lochleven for a year. In May 1568, she was liberated by followers, but her army was defeated by Murray at the Battle of Langside. Mary then fled to England, expecting to be received as an honoured guest. But Elizabeth couldn't afford to be generous when English Roman Catholics regarded Catholic Mary, not Protestant Elizabeth, as the rightful English queen, and so Elizabeth had Mary imprisoned. Even in prison, though, Mary was a danger. One Roman Catholic plot after another was hatched to topple Elizabeth and replace her with Mary. Eventually, in 1587, when the Babington plot was exposed, in which Mary herself was implicated in a conspiracy to assassinate Elizabeth, Elizabeth's patience was at an end, and Mary was executed. After Mary's flight to England, there remained a Queen's party in Scotland working for her restoration. The Queen's party was led by Maitland and Kirkcaldy of Grange. The opposing party, the King's party, more committed to Protestantism, was led by Knox's great friend, the Regent Murray. The conflict boiled up and came to a head in 1570 when Murray was assassinated. Civil war broke out. Knox himself was almost assassinated. A shot was fired one night through the window of his study, and if he had been at his accustomed place, it would probably have killed him. The situation in Edinburgh became so dangerous that Knox had to leave and camp in St. Andrews. He was heartbroken by the Civil War because his old friend Kirkcaldy of Grange, who had done so much to advance the Protestant cause in Scotland, was now fighting for Mary. It seemed a sad end to Kirkcaldy's life. Knox himself was by now a very ill man, having suffered a stroke, and he no longer preached with the power that had once captivated a nation. He devoted much of his time to writing up his History of the Reformation in Scotland. Eventually, the Civil War ended in the triumph of the King's party, led by the Earl of Morton. Morton accomplished the final destruction of the Queen's party in 1573, when, with the aid of English artillery and engineers, he captured Edinburgh Castle, the last stronghold of the Queen's party. Meanwhile, Knox's own life had drawn to a close. In his last days, as he lay in bed, he kept on asking friends to read to him from John chapter 17, his favourite passage in the Bible, the so-called high priestly prayer of Christ to the Father. He died on November the 24th, 1572, and was buried in the churchyard of St. Giles. The Earl of Morton spoke a famous epitaph at the funeral. "There lies one who neither feared nor flattered any flesh." Perhaps we can also quote the testimony of a modern biographer of Knox, Geddes MacGregor. Commenting on Knox's reputation for bigotry and arrogance, MacGregor says, "He was not as arrogant a man as he often appears, and few great men in history have been more aware of their own shortcomings. He repeatedly accused himself of churlishness and begged his friends to bear with it. He was subject to moodiness and depression. His temperament and his poor health both contributed to mild fits of melancholy. But the worst of him was on the outside. His tenderness breaks through his prophetic vehemence as sunshine through the storm clouds. His humble simplicity rises up from his dour determination as the snowdrop through the hard winter earth. It was for these qualities that his friends loved him in their hearts. Certain it is that the effect of Knox was what that old prophet, Isaiah, had expected of such a man when he predicted that the tongue of the stammerers shall be ready to speak plainly. For whatever Knox may have failed to do, he made his countrymen articulate." And at that point, we come to an end, or at least an end of the talk.